Good morning and welcome to the KBBI Coffee Table. Today's theme will be gardening and Homer. I am here with some special guests. I've got Brenda Adams, Donna Ray Faulkner, and Tony Burgess from the Homer Garden Club. And I have asked them all to think about two or three favorite unusual plants that are overlooked by a lot of Homer gardeners. So, Tony, we'll start with you since you're right next to me.
Well, one that you see around town but that just really cheers my soul and is easy to grow is the common herb valerian. It's a nice perennial. It reseeds well, but about early summer it sends up this gorgeous flowering stalk and is covered with these white blooms that just emit this heavenly smell from noon on that enchants the garden. So it's like being in paradise for a month. And then, of course, I leave the stalks on because I don't mind it going to seed because it can sort of volunteer where it wants, and I edit it out. And then the garden just gets sweeter and sweeter smelling every summer. So that's certainly a huge favorite.
Excellent. Brenda?
Well, I think my very favorite plant is called Astrantia. Now, it's Astrantia major. That sounds like a botanical name, and it is. It's also got a common name of pincushion plant. But there are a couple of other plants with the same common name, so it can be a little bit confusing. So Astrantia major is a beautiful ornamental plant, grows to about 2.5 feet tall. And what I love about it is it blooms from Memorial Day to Labor Day in my garden. So it blooms for a good 2+ months. It's great in a vase. It'll stay fresh for 2 weeks in the vase, has beautiful foliage, and you can dry it at the end of the season. Most of the cultivars are burgundy, but there are also some pink ones and some white ones. It's just lovely. Another real favorite is sea holly or Eryngium. And the two cultivars of that I like the best, and by the way, cultivar just means cultivated variety. That means a human has come into the mix somehow, either by selection or by crossing.
Kind of like a breed in an animal?
Yes, exactly. A Cocker Spaniel versus a Collie.
Right.
But Eryngium or sea holly, blue glitter or big blue are both fantastic. They look kind of like a thistle, but they're a very well-behaved plant. The flower starts the season kind of a silvery white and then starts getting deeper and deeper, almost an iridescent blue. The stems turn purple. And that little bit of silver from the beginning of the flower starts to show up in the veining of the leaves. And then in fall, it becomes another spectacular color where the blue turns chocolate and the stems fade a little bit from rich purple to more of a lavender. So it just keeps on giving all season long. It's a great plant. Both of those are very simple to grow, very easy to maintain.
Donna Ray, what have you got for us?
Oh, gosh, there's so many great vegetables to grow indoors and out. I would say artichokes are one that if you're not growing outdoors is a really good one.
Really? They grow here?
They grow really well, and the plants are beautiful. So they're a nice big bush. You can get some wonderful artichokes off of them. There's a green globe artichoke, and there's an imperial star. Both of them are really wonderful in the area. We haven't found the violetta, the purple one, to be as productive for a food plant, but it's still a beautiful plant if you like just for an ornamental or a little bit of food. And it's also really nice if you're growing artichokes to wait at the end of the season. The ones that aren't going to make it into big artichokes, if you cut those off and pickle them, you can make a marinated artichoke and jar those. It's just fantastic. So don't miss out on those last ones that haven't grown big. The other thing I would encourage people to do is try some of the different varieties of potatoes. If you're used to growing one kind of potato, there's a wide range of them. So there's some that like a Magic Myrna that's almost like a sweet potato here, but it's a regular potato and grows just as easy as other potatoes around here. And in terms of greens, I would say if you're not growing arugula, it's a very strong flavor. People sort of love or hate it, but I love it. And I think arugula or lemon sorrel would really wake up your taste buds as a couple of greens to grow.
Nice. Well, we're going to talk about dirt here in just a minute. But first, you guys have a couple of events coming up. And the first one, I know Brenda is very excited about this one. Sunday the 8th, April 8th at 3 p.m., The Homer Garden Club will have Kit Strange from Kew Gardens in England at the Homer United Methodist Church. Can you talk a little bit about what that's going to be about?
Yes, I can. It is open to the public, and Kit is in charge of propagation of all the rock gardens at Kew Gardens, which is just a fabulous garden in England. I think it's probably my favorite of all of the public gardens there. And she's on about a month-long tour of the West Coast, and she's starting out with us. The talk she's going to give to our group and to all of you who would like to come at 3 o'clock at the Methodist Church is at 3 o'clock on April 8th at the Methodist Church. She's going to talk about being a better propagator, which is a really useful thing if you're trying to make more plants without investing a ton of money. So she's extraordinarily knowledgeable.
Well, that sounds pretty awesome. Well, let's talk about dirt a little bit, since dirt is obviously sort of the key to growing plants. And one problem a lot of us around here have is poor soil drainage and clay soils and high water tables and all that kind of thing. And Tony, I know you're kind of the resident soil guy. So what are the best things that a gardener can do to improve their soil drainage?
Well, the expensive thing, of course, is install a tile, but that's really costly.
What does a tile involve?
Well, you have to basically dig a ditch and then put a perforated tile in and surround it with gravel.
A French drain, kind of?
Well, yes, with soil on top.
Right.
But I find more cost-effectively is just to either dig down a little bit and just put a big bed of wood chips. Or in the case, this is called Hugel culture, and it was developed in Northern Europe for poorly drained soils. Just put in logs, branches, trees, anything like that, and then pile the dirt on top, and you'll automatically raise the dirt up above. In fact, you can pile up the wood up to 2-3 feet above ground level, put the soil on top, and put your seeds right in on that. And gradually the trees will decay over a period of years. But by that time, your root systems will be established well above the flood zone. Or just more simply, put in a bunch of wood chips and raise the bed. Bring in topsoil and put it in higher over the thing, and you can bound the whole bed with downed wood. Any kind of log or anything will do, or you can be fancier and raise it up with railroad ties or something.
Oh, wow. So that doesn't... Because I've always heard that adding wood chips can be kind of difficult because it ties up a lot of nitrogen, but you're saying that if you put it deep enough, it helps to drain it? And
well, it will tie up nitrogen at first, but it's the tying up of the nitrogen is transient, and of course soil here is fed from the top. And all these wood rotters depend on nitrogen coming in from whatever you apply on the surface. So if I've got a plant that's going into a hole that's poorly drained, I'll put a lot of wood chips in. Then put some really rich compost right over the top of the wood chips. Then put in your soil and your plant. The nutrients from the compost will leach right into the wood chips and jumpstart the microbial activity there. And then top dress your soil as you normally would in a garden with really rich compost. And those nutrients will come down and feed your plant as it gets started.
Oh.
So, yeah, I think it depends too how severe your problem is.
Right.
You know, a lot of soils just with the additive of a lot of compost, the compost that you can create yourself by keeping your greens and your vegetable scraps and so on, will always improve the aeration and therefore the drainage of your soil. And in an ornamental gardening, which I do a lot of, one of the things that we always do as we build a bed for flowers is to raise the elevation, not necessarily with wood chips, as Tony was talking about, but just to mound up the soil so that it's higher than anything that's surrounding it. So if you've got lawn or a driveway or whatever, you want to have your garden bed raised up so that during freeze-thaw, there's a place for the water to run away. So our climate is not particularly cold compared to other parts of the country, but we mostly lose plants because of poor drainage. I'm talking about perennial plants, because when freeze-thaw happens, if the water's not draining away, it's either the plant will sit in the water and rot, or the water will freeze and suffocate the plants, because roots need air as well as water.
Right.
So raising your bed will go a long way toward helping your situation.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that our climate isn't particularly cold, you know, considered cold from like a gardening standpoint, because, you know, what zone are we? You see a lot of talk about zones, and I know, and everybody's laughing now, but it's one of those basic gardener questions, you know, because you, that's how you look at the seed catalogs and there's zone 3 to zone 6 or whatever. And then, you know, you look at the zone map and it doesn't really necessarily, especially up here, seem to correspond with reality. So,
yeah. Good question. I just made the revision for our forthcoming Ketchumet Gardeners book on the zones. So I checked. Traditionally, the rule of thumb in Homer is if you're up high at zone 3, if you're below about 500 feet, zone 4.
Okay.
However, if you look at the last 10 years of climate, it has gotten so much warmer that if you go to the USDA hardiness website, and click on Homer, you will get zone 6. Now, I don't know about Brenda and Donna Ray, but I haven't had much luck with any plant surviving in zone 6 in Homer. No. So don't believe the USDA website,
yes,
folks.
Absolutely.
Well, it is
not.
part of the reason for that, not just because it doesn't necessarily get that cold here, but we have a very long
and that's,
cold season.
That's exactly the key. The length of our winter actually has the effect of at least one zone.
Okay.
So it takes it down a notch. But I think the USDA got a little carried away with itself. No matter what, I would not spend any money on zone 6 plants. I mean, unless there's just one little thing that you want to spend $10 on because you really have to try it. And in fact, there's nothing wrong with experimenting and seeing what you can grow, because, you know, going back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, people said, well, there are 50 perennials that you can grow. And I've now built a database of plants I've grown successfully in my gardens and in client gardens. That's over 2,000 kinds of plants. So,
wow.
And a lot of those plants were considered, you know, a higher zone. They were zone 5, and I've successfully grown them in zone 3. So it is worth experimenting, because a lot of the cultivated plants are developed and tested outside. And so they don't have zone 3 places to trial the plants, and they're not going to claim that it will work in zone 3 when they haven't tested it. But over time, with feedback from gardeners to them, they start to adjust the zone levels on plants.
Well, that's a good segue, actually, because Donna Ray, they tell me you're the high tunnel and soil, artificial soil warming expert.
Oh my
so,
goodness.
Can you talk, you seem like you're bursting at the seams now. Can you talk a little bit about warming the soil and warming the environment around the plants?
Oh gosh, there's a lot of different ways, and it depends on where you are and what you are growing and what your high tunnel situation is, or your greenhouse situation is, or your outdoor situation is. One of the sort of general ways to do that, and I'll have Tony add some more to me, but one of the general ways is through different ground covers or plastic mulches like IRT fabrics, which are sort of a plastic infrared technology fabric that brings in a lot of warmth. And so if you cover that soil with IRT plastic, which you can buy in rolls or you can buy cut off of rolls, that'll warm your soil very well. You can use other kinds of ground covers. Some of them are weed blocking and some are not. You can put some containers of water sometimes inside of your buildings, such that your high tunnel or your greenhouse will have some sink for the heat from the solar. At our little place, we have some solar thermal collectors that we built just out of screening and painting black in containers, crevasse to warm the air inside that high tunnel. Some of the other ways, Tony?
How about cold frames?
No. Oh, cold frames are a good one too. So just some small, you can have cloches, little tiny covers over individual plants. You can have some cold frames that would be on the ground and have a cover over the top that you can open and close.
Do you find in general that it's better to try to warm the soil or warm the air around the soil? Or does it really matter that much?
I would say both are important, but especially the soil temperature is a really critical factor for plants. So that's the deal breaker for most plants growing in Alaska, especially the vegetables.
Well, that actually leads to, so now you've got your greenhouse or your high tunnel, and so you're starting to start seeds, which is right around now, I think would be when most people are getting most things. In fact, some people might have some things going already. What should you already have going right now, Tony?
Well, we're running a little behind this year, but I would say any of your longer-lived perennials that you want to start from seed, such as old bergamot, something like that, that it'll take a while to get established. Also, some of the things that take longer to germinate, like parsley, carrots, and parsnip, they'll take 2 to 3 weeks to germinate, so I definitely get them in now or pretty soon.
Artichokes, too. I usually start my artichokes the 1st of February. How about you, Donna Ray?
Our artichokes, we're behind in a lot of things, too, but as every gardener might be. But we have artichokes well started at this point, and a bunch of different tomatoes and things like that. It's really good to have started those if you're going to do that. Tomatoes don't do well outdoors here in Alaska. They might work under low tunnels or some sort of cover outside. We grow ours in high tunnels, and they grow really well.
But yeah, tomatoes are one of my... I pretty much, having lived in Alaska for 17 years now, I've resigned myself to the fact that I'm never really going to have a good tomato again unless I go outside during the summer.
Oh, no, get yourself a greenhouse.
I do have a greenhouse, but I've never been... You know, once you've had a real field-ripened hot tomato, they're just... it's just not the same. The greenhouse ones are all right, but this is... The seed conversation is a good... time to talk about Saturday, May 19th. If you've not started your plants, the Homer Garden Club is having their annual Garden Club plant sale at the Homer Chamber of Commerce there in the parking lot. Brenda, would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. This is a tradition of the Garden Club that goes back at least 30 years, and it's gotten bigger and better over the years. It's very gracious of the chamber to let us hold it there because we ran out of space at the City Hall parking lot. But we have annuals that people have started from seed for the sale. Lots of the gardeners, Garden Club members, will have dug up perennials from their gardens and divided them, so there are a lot of mature perennial plants. Oftentimes, you'll find some raspberry canes or other fruit-bearing shrubs. This year, we're going to have a new thing. One of the tents is going to have gardening gear. So Garden Club members who have tools that they don't use anymore or support structures or maybe gardening books that they've read and don't reference anymore, those things will also be available this year for the first time. And it is, it's at 10 o'clock, I think you mentioned, on the 19th of May at the Chamber. You'll see Garden Club members there with their aprons on getting everything ready, but we hold back the crowds until 10 o'clock and cut the ribbon, and then people can dash in and buy frantically. There are a lot of good deals. It's always a lot of fun.
And that's right around the time when you can start thinking about putting things in the ground. I know the traditional cutoff around here is Memorial Day weekend for actually planting outside. Mm-hmm. I live up on top of West Hill, so it always seems like I still have snow on the ground on Memorial Day weekend. But does that still hold pretty true, do you find, these days, even though, you know, the weather's getting a little iffy sometimes?
I do. We rarely plant anything, certainly ornamental, before that because of what Donna Ray was saying. The soil is too cold. But there are some food crops that you can put in before that, some of the cold crops. I don't know if you want to talk to that, Tony. You've been a little quiet, but some of the ones that can tolerate cold, like kale or even carrots or
definitely,
broccoli.
Definitely, yeah.
Oh, you can plant carrots that early?
Well, you have to harden them off, so you definitely want to put them outside, gradually getting them first with overhead shelter and then finally completely no shelter, and watch your weather. If there's a hard freeze coming, get them back in.
Right.
But it's usually worth the gamble to go ahead and set them out, and definitely kale and most of the brassica-type crops you can start to think about putting in because they can handle the light frost, or maybe throw some Remay frost cloth over them or something like that. Mm. And the fact is, I just looked at this when we were revising the Garden Club book and talked to some people that had been here, and it does look like within the last 20 years, we have added almost a month to our average growing season in Homer.
Oh, wow.
Down low.
Uh-huh.
So definitely you can start looking to plant things earlier than traditionally, especially if you're below 300 feet.
And is it a problem? Because sometimes I wonder, you know, when I start digging up, how far down do you need to be frost-free before you really think, you know, I can plant? I mean, should I, if I can just get the plant in the ground, is that okay? Or, you know, if it's, if the ice is down a foot, is that okay?
It depends on the crop. If it's one of the, again, if it's one of the cabbage family, then you're probably okay. But some of these other things like carrots, those taprooted things, if you've got frozen soil below, I'd wait.
Okay. All right. I will.
I would definitely consider what Tony was saying, too, about putting some woven spun fabric, either the Rime or Agribond or the kind of commercial names for a lot of that. But that little blanket over them at night will be a big help no matter what the crop is. We try and cover them in the beginning of the season.
And does that help with weeds as well? Or does it, is that more of just a warming the fabric?
What it really helps with is some of the pests.
Like, oh, really?
If you get turnip maggots or something like that, root maggots in your mustard-type family crops, you need to keep that over there so the adults won't lay eggs in there. Keep it on till July is the rule of thumb.
Huh. Well, that pest is a good thing to talk about now, because we have, especially the last few years, we seem to have this issue where, and we have a fence. It's apparently not enough of a fence. My wife says, I was literally going out to harvest, you know, whatever today, the broccoli today, and I walk outside and there's a moose in the yard. So aside from, you know, a giant, awesome, bulletproof fence, Tony, you actually had a really interesting idea that we were talking about before the show for what seems to work for you as like an inexpensive way to keep moose out, which is...
Well, it doesn't keep them out, but it keeps them away from plants I don't want, which is Plant Devil's Club, which, of course, I like, but it is very spiny. It's hard to go. You don't want to put it around a lot of traffic, but I find whatever I put the Devil's Club around, the moose seem to steer clear of.
That's genius. You just have to leave enough of a path for yourself to get through without
right.
scratching
now,
yourself.
Another one
up
that'll
too bad.
Work that way, which is lower, is wormwood, the Artemisia.
Really?
Yeah, it's really stinky, but it is toxic to other plants, so it'll suppress the growth of plants near it. But I've noticed that anything I've got near wormwood, the moose don't go near.
Huh. What about? I know we tried it one year, and it didn't really seem to work, but there's that I can't remember what it's called, plant skid, the blood
uh-huh.
stuff,
right?
It seemed like maybe we didn't apply it enough, because supposedly do you find that works?
I tried plant skid on trees and shrubs to protect them through the winter, and the first couple of years it worked great, and then I don't know whether it was because the winter was more severe or the moose got smart. But by the third year, it was no longer effective for me, you know. So, and I didn't particularly like it, because it really is offensive in the smell. And if you get it on your clothes, they're done. So it really stains terribly. But we also should differentiate, I think, when we're talking about moose, between wintertime and summertime, because in the winter, what they're eating is woody crops. So it's your shrubs and trees that you have to. That you have to protect. And I've found that protecting trees, particularly with that big wire mesh that is used in concrete construction, that's pretty high. And if you put that around your trees, that will keep the moose off, but you have to stake it in. So what we'll do is get a 5-foot length of rebar and put two or three of those, or depending on the size of the cage or the size of the tree, and pound that into the soil about halfway, and then lash the cage to the rebar, because otherwise they'll just knock the cage over. But that'll work. And then the trick, of course, is making sure that there is native browse available to your moose, and that the moose in your neighborhood like that before you take the cages down in the spring. But then I think you were referring earlier to food crops and keeping them out of your broccoli patch and stuff. And I think, you know, it depends on where you're gardening. Different moose have different habits and are afraid of different things. There was a great gardener down on right on the bluff, right by the water, that he just had a rope around his vegetable garden with some fluttering things, mm-hmm. and that was sufficient.
That didn't work on our moose.
Other people need an 8-foot-high fence. And one thing I have read is that if they can't see over it, they won't jump over it. But, you know, who wants to put up a completely,
right,
you know, not can't look through it fence? I mean, that's pretty hardcore.
And so when you're designing for ornamental landscape gardening, you know, where you can't necessarily protect it all, is it mostly about plant choice and trying to pick shrubs that they don't want to eat? Or is there anything you can do about the bushes around your house?
Well, so some people fence their entire property, and then that generates all kind of plant envy in those of us who don't have our whole property fenced. But when you do that, you really do need a fence that is going to be high enough when you have snow cover that's frozen. Like this time of year, there's a crust on the snow. So if you have a 10-foot fence and you get 5 feet of snow, then effectively, this time of year, you only have a 5-foot fence, and they'll just step over it. But there are shrubs, particularly, I don't really know of any trees that moose won't bother, which is why we individually wrap them. But there are several categories of shrubs that I've not so far ever had a moose bother. But I'm not going to say they won't do it, because if they're starving, they'll eat anything. But the spireas, the Japanese barberries, which is Barbarus thunbergii, which have fabulous, fabulous foliage colors. They have really big thorns, and they don't seem to bother those. Mock oranges, which have wonderful scent and a big white flower. They don't bother those. And then potentillas, which you see a lot around. They're fairly common with the little leaves on the highway strips. You'll see them or parking lot strips with kind of a garish yellow. But potentilla comes in all kinds of other very lovely colors, pinks and soft oranges and whites and so on. So those groups of shrubs are pretty bulletproof when it comes to moose. But trees, you know, and again, it depends. Some gardeners have moose in their gardens all summer long. Others of us are very lucky, and after they drop their calves, they move on, so we can take our cages down and we don't have to worry about it. Some of the lilacs are uninteresting to moose. I don't know, you guys pitch in here if you've got some other suggestions, but those are categories that you can pretty much use with abandon and not have to worry too much about them being eaten summer or winter.
And you can be selective about where you put your fence if you're, like, fences can be expensive, so we don't have fences around everything all the time. And so things like potatoes will grow, and the moose will basically step on them possibly, but right, they generally don't eat them. So you can choose some of your crops accordingly. Some of the other fencing technique kind of ideas, I thought Calypso Farms did a great job way out in Esther, where they, in the same vein as not being able to see over where they can jump, they have a fence about 4 feet away from the other fence, and it's not very tall, but they said they won't try and jump a span like that. So if you had a double fence,
two short fences rather than one,
or one short one and one as high, right, as you can make it, you know. Huh. So
Donna Ray, you grow a lot of things inside, or, you know, inside high tunnels. What other pests do you see, not just inside but outside on vegetables? What are our big worries and killers up here?
Oh, gosh. Well, outside, of course, a lot of people have experienced the snowshoe hares around during certain times, and so sometimes they're a problem. This past year hasn't been too much of an issue for us. Certainly a lot of the insect and other kinds of small pests like aphids or slugs are common problems, pest problems around.
Is it? What's your favorite slug counter? Is it the classic dish of beer, or do you have something even better?
Oh, no. In my house, that's sacrilege to use beer on slugs. So we have some hydrogen peroxide usually in a little squirt bottle, and we can shoot them with that, or we can pick them up. And I'm pretty much a hand slug picker. That's unfortunately the way we do it. That's kind of our main slug control.
Yeah, I carry around a little Tupperware thing of salt, and I open up the lid and just throw them in there and
you
shake it around.
Like to watch them dehydrate slowly.
Yeah, and they just melt. It's really fun.
At our farm, we like ducks.
Ooh, yeah.
They just gobble them down. So wherever the ducks can go, and then you get eggs out of them.
So I've always heard this, because I have chickens, and we don't really let our chickens run around in the garden because they just destroy everything. But I've heard that ducks and geese will eat the insects, but won't necessarily go after the plants.
Oh, that's not true with the geese. The geese are primarily plant eaters, but why we let them roam is because their favorite food most times in the early part of the year is horsetail.
Oh,
so
really?
So they keep the horsetails trimmed down to an inch or two.
Well, that might be a good argument for my wife to finally get geese.
Well, they're companionable if you treat them right.
Right.
They can be pretty aggressive,
too. Will they chase off a moose?
They definitely will let you know and everybody know if anything comes around that they don't like. Huh. So they'll alert you to a moose, I'll put it that way.
Do you find that, because when we had ducks, we did have a small problem with them liking, they really like to take a nap in the ornamentals around our garden and sort of smush them all. Do you find that that's an issue with ducks in general?
Definitely. You've got to have your plants up beyond the seedling stage before you let the ducks and geese or anything in on them.
Right.
If they're seedlings, they're nailed. And that's just true with any animal traffic.
Yep. Unfortunately, yes. You just can't train them, especially when they're young. So Sunday, May the 27th at 2 p.m., the Homer Garden Club is going to be holding a meeting and a talk with Jody Anderson on soils and composting at the Bidarka. And this is very exciting because I happen to be very excited about soils and composting. Donna Ray,
oh, great.
What do you got for us?
Yes, our wonderful friend Jody Anderson is going to be coming down from Anchorage, and she is the Alaska Farm to School Coordinator for the whole state of Alaska. She has a wonderful listserv if you're involved with schools or you want to do some grant writing or support school gardens. You can get on her listserv. But she'll be down here. She has a PhD in soil biochemistry. She's worked at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the Cooperative Extension Service and the Natural Resources Agricultural Sciences for a number of years. She was worked for an engineering and environmental consulting firm as a soil scientist. She's done a lot of things, but make no mistake about it, she's a lot of fun, and she gets super excited about soils and composting, especially organically, building your soil, building your nitrogen, and community gardening. So she'll be here to answer all kinds of questions. She'll talk as much as you want about how to interpret soil tests, so she'll give you some of the highlights of a soil test and what she looks for and what isn't so concerning and what is concerning when you get a soil test done. Working compost, she has all sorts of ideas, and she said bring soil samples if you'd like, and they'll do a little demo on textures of soil. So if you come to that meeting, she'll make it a lot of fun. And so we highly recommend that you come see her.
All right, and that is the 27th of May at 2 p.m. at the Bidarka. So let's talk about composting a little bit.
And may I just add?
Cause yes, you may.
Somebody has just called in, obviously, from the Garden Club, because I apparently had the wrong time frame for the opening of the plant sales. So it is the actual purchase of plants is not until 11 a.m., but I guess you can look at plants starting at 10. But they
and hover next to the ones you want.
I guess. I don't know exactly how they're going to organize it this year, but it's 11 o'clock is the ribbon cutting that you can purchase.
So 11 a.m. on Saturday the 19th.
But come on by at 10 and look around, and they'll have coffee and things like that there.
All right. Well, so let's talk about composting a little bit, because I've actually finally, now that I have chickens, I've kind of hit the point where my compost pile is actually somewhat efficient, because, you know, for years and years and years I had one, and it was the usual, you know, throw the clippings on and throw the junk that you find when you clear around the yard on and all that stuff. And it was always so slow. It seemed like it was, you know, it would take 2 or 3 years really for it to finally break down. But now that I have chickens, magically it happens really quickly. But still, even now, you know, it's not even as fast as the ones that you see. Like, you know, you read people in the lower 48 and they're like, I started this compost pile and 6 weeks later it's smoking, you know. So Tony, can you talk a little bit about how to build your compost pile up here to where it doesn't take so long just because it's cold?
Well, here's a clue. We chip alder, and very often if that pile is more than about 4 feet high, within 4 days after chipping, it's steaming. Hmm. So it's mainly a matter of how much volume do you have.
Bigger the better, huh?
Yeah, if you've got a big volume, then that heat from decomposition spreads inward, and the heat then that spreads inward feeds up the microbes, which compost even faster, and the heat from their compost spreads outward, and you get a feedback loop.
Right.
But if the compost pile is small, or if it's spread thinly, you simply have too much contact with the outside air and soil for it to really diverge in temperature from their environment. Mm-hmm. So the big thing is try to go for a pile that's at least 4 by 4 by 4. Or if you can't do that, then somehow shelter it with a cover or something like that so that there's less contact with the cooling effects of the environment or the cold rain. The other thing you did, and you notice this with your chickens, is the rate of microbes gobbling all that stuff up and respiring is a function of your carbon nitrogen. So if you have a lot of nitrogen per carbon, then that speeds them up.
Right.
And your clue is when you've got too much, if you start to smell ammonia coming off, then you've got too much, you're losing your nitrogen and ammonia rather than in putting it back into the soil. So I just keep adding high ammonia stuff like vegetables and manure and stuff until I get that whiff of nitrogen when I stir it a little bit, and then add some high carbon stuff like dried hay or something like that.
And then how often do you like to turn your pile, or do you?
You don't have to, but if you really want to heat it up, then you probably want to turn it, and you can use a long stem compost thermometer, and you'll, after the temperature begins to decline, during the first cooling, then turn it once and it'll heat up again. But that's if you want an 8 or 9 week turnaround. If you're not in a hurry, the critters will usually take care of it. And then what I do usually is just turn it at the beginning and end of the season. Mm-hmm. And by the beginning of the third season, it's definitely ready. But usually by the middle of the second season, it's completely ready.
Right. And so, you know, the other thing that happens sometimes, depending on where you're getting your, like now I never had chickweed before, and now magically I have chickweed by my compost pile. So how, is there any good way really other than getting your pile super hot to sort of mitigate weeds like that?
The more you turn, I mean, the point is if you have weed seeds in there and if they germinate due to the heat, now of course if it's above 130 Fahrenheit in there, which it can get to if you've got it really hot, that'll kill the weed seeds. But of course the ones on the outside won't be, so you need to turn it and get the outside stuff in. Mm-hmm. The other thing though is turn it and just keep churning it so that the germinating seeds get killed.
Oh, and then they just eventually the plants.
Yeah, and never forget the power of chickens around chickweed.
they do like it. I mean, that's definitely why it's called that.
Mm-hmm.
Brenda?
The alternative is to never put weed seeds into your compost pile. I never put weeds in my compost pile.
Well, I don't know where they came from because, I didn't have... the only thing... Because I did notice that I started getting it after I got my chickens. So I don't know if maybe they found the one little patch of chickweed that was there that I didn't know about, or if it came in their food, or if it came in, you know, something I gave them to eat. But somehow the weed seeds got in there, and that stuff is impossible to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to get rid of it?
Tenacity.
Mm-hmm. Just keep after the weeding.
Is that the same thing with with horsetail? Because we have horsetail too, and
horsetail's different.
horsetail makes me sad.
Well, actually, horsetail, when you pull it up, have you ever watched how deep that root system goes?
Yes, I have.
Precisely. What it's doing for you is bringing up a lot of nutrients from very deep, especially it's important. And in the clay soils that I have at my place, basically those roots decay and make little channels that a lot of other nutrients and other roots can get into. So in many ways, horsetail is the ideal soil conditioner for the raw, clay-rich soils that we have, especially on the Homer bench.
Huh.
The neat thing is that if you do keep on top of weeding them or mulch them heavily, they'll be gone in 2 or 3 years because their job is done.
Right. So you're saying I should make friends with my horsetail and use
it?
Well,
I do. And of course, as I said before, the geese just love it.
Yeah. And will they dig down and get it, or will they?
No, what they do is, on ours anyway, they make a neat little lawn where it's thick. They'll just trim it off to about an inch and a half, and you get a little horsetail lawn.
Huh.
To give you a more serious answer on chickweed, There are two things about it. Once you have it, is be very careful to never let it go to seed again, because the seeds are viable for years. But the other thing is that it's one of those weeds where you can grab it and pull it, and it's gone really fast, and you think you've accomplished something, but you haven't, because the plant has a very, very fine single stem that goes to the root. And if you pull it, you're going to break that off. The root is still there, and so it will be back right away. Mm-hmm. So you just really have to take your trowel and pop it out. It's very easy. It's not a big root, but it is a root. And so if you just keep after it and never, ever let it go, it or any other weed,
yeah,
you don't.
It sounds like you're describing dandelion, too.
Well, all of those things. I mean, if you let weeds go to seed, then you have a big problem.
Right.
When you start with a new garden, if you never let anything go to seed, then you don't ever have a lot of problems, with the exception of horsetail, because it's indigenous and it is very, very deep in the soil. But when you are planting a plant that you've bought, even if it's at the Home or Garden Club plant sale, or if you've bought it from a nursery, before you plant it, I recommend that you always take the top quarter inch or 3/8 inch, if you can, off the plant, and the bottom 1/2 inch off the plant, and discard that soil, not in your compost pile, but actually discard it someplace away from where you're going to garden. Because that top layer is where seeds will be that are wandering along with the plant. That's where your chickweed seeds might have come from.
That's true.
And on the bottom of the plant is where slugs are laying their eggs. And whereas it's pretty easy to spot a slug when you take a plant out of a pot, you might miss the eggs. So if you take that bottom soil off too, you're less likely to introduce slugs. So both of those, if you are meticulous about it, every time you plant a plant, that will really help you. And, you know, a lot of people love horse manure. I don't, because not for a perennial garden. It's fine if you want to do it in your vegetable garden where you're cleaning up every year. But horses just, you know, go straight through, and all the seeds go right through. Whatever they were eating, you're going to get in your garden. So
yeah, I definitely noticed that when we used to live across the bay, and we had some neighbors that had horses, and they let us take as much as we wanted. And it was great because, you know, it was great for the garden, but man, the compost pile was just covered in green at the partway through the summer. So let's shift gears a little bit, because I like talking about fruit as well. And not just the kind of fruit that is easy to grow here, which obviously is the raspberries and the berries and rhubarb, but what about like apple trees, and what other kinds of fruit is it possible to grow here, other than the stuff that we're used to growing? Donna Ray?
Well, we're trying a number of different things. We enjoy growing strawberries, so there's a lot of strawberry growing that can happen too. Again, you have to be careful of moose. Definitely want to fence that area off. Outdoor apple trees are certainly a possibility. Most of them are grafted onto a cold, hardy rootstock like Anna Navaca, and then you can graft branches of other trees, pieces of what they call scion wood, onto those branches, and those would be the branches of that species or type of apple. So you could have a Honeycrisp or something on that Anna Navaca rootstock, although the Honeycrisp apple tree wouldn't grow well here because its root doesn't really work.
Right.
So there's a lot of different ones. There's tons of different berries, from aronia to Swedish black currants. I would encourage everybody to try some different ones, and even the raspberries. Try some golden raspberries in your garden. And there's a lot of good homesteader raspberries around.
Do you know anybody that's actually been able to get blackberries to grow here, or is it just too cold?
I don't know anybody yet. So we're going to try a couple that we kind of scoffed when we were vacationing down in Oregon State. So we'll see how they grow. I'm not so sure about that, but it's a small investment to try some different things.
How about indoor citrus? I've always kind of wanted to have like a little Meyer lemon tree in a pot that I could keep in my house.
Well, what you can do versus what you really want to do is a different thing altogether. So if you really want to heat your area or greenhouse, in many cases, you can do those kinds of things. You could have a banana tree growing in home or maybe inside, but you probably don't really want those heating bills and so forth.
Well, I was just wondering if I could keep it inside my house in a sunny spot, in a pot.
I'll defer to Tony on that. You might have an idea. I have never even attempted a citrus.
I don't do citrus. I do pelargonium. But the key here is you just don't have enough winter light. So if you're, because citrus are evergreen, you're going to have to put it under artificial light for at least a couple of months around the winter solstice. And then if you want to do it and baby it along, sure, if it's a pet, yeah, you could do it.
Interesting. So maybe I should get rid of my dreams of becoming an Alaskan citrus farmer.
Oh, dream no small dreams.
That's it. But there are an awful lot of really nice berries. We were talking earlier and saying that gooseberries are a really good shrub to grow here.
All right. Sounds like we have a caller. We have Wes on line one. Wes, do we have you?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Go ahead with your question.
Well, actually, it's more like a comment. I noticed in a lot of areas our soil is becoming less acidic, and our blueberries of the high bush variety aren't as prolific, but there's a berry from northern Japan called Hascap, or honeyberry, and they grow quite well down here in the Homer area. And I noticed that Brian Olson at the Alaska Berry Farm, he's got Hascap. And I know some people have planted Hascap berries, and they found after 3 to 5 years, you get a whole bush full of berries. And they're more nutritious and delicious than blueberries.
Would you compare them to a blueberry and like their flavor and what you would use them for?
Actually, they look a lot like a blueberry, except they're more elongated shape. And, you can use them for the same thing as blueberries, muffins, jam, syrup, or just dry them and put them in granola.
Interesting. I bet you can
make, really good.
I bet you can make wine out of it, too.
Oh, you can make wine. You can make liqueur, which is really tasty as well.
Yeah, that's another shrub that most don't bother very much either, is the Hascap berries. They might nibble a little bit. The birds are a bigger issue, is that I find the berries to be fairly tart, and when I try to leave them on the bush long enough to get sweet, I don't usually get many because the birds get them.
So Brenda, what do you recommend for shrubs? Because I happen to like shrubs. You know, I kind of wish that, you know, we had enough history here to be like, you know, like in England, where you walk down the road and every single house is surrounded by shrubs and there's shrubs everywhere. And so what's your favorite kinds of shrubbery for a home or gardener to?
Well, the ones that I mentioned earlier, because you don't have to worry about moose, the spireas, particularly, there's one called pink parasols that I just love. All of the Japanese barberries are gorgeous with their dark or orange or golden foliage. The mock oranges, because they're so fragrant, and I like to, but they only bloom for a fairly short time, and the foliage of a mock orange is not that great, so it's kind of fun to grow a clematis vine into it so that you have a flower either earlier or later in that same shrub structure. That's hard to say. There are lots and lots of other shrubs that are just lovely and very hardy for us, but they are moose candy. Mm. There's a beautiful little willow that's called Salix purpurea nana that is got a kind of a gray-blue leaf, very fine leaf, and a chocolate stem. It's really pretty.
But you said willow and all the moose ears around us just perked up.
Yes, it's a Salix. It's just like it. We have grown some of them at one of the condominium projects that won't let us. They don't want cages in the wintertime. And we've got a half dozen of them up there. The moose chomp them right down to about an inch from the ground, and they come back beautifully every year. So some shrubs will survive being eaten. Others, like all of the dogwoods, the red twig dogwoods or golden twig dogwoods, are beautiful, but you do have to protect those from the moose. The moose will definitely eat those, and they don't do very well afterwards. There are a ton of different shrubs that you can try. I would go to our local nurseries, both Alaska Hardy on the way out of town and Wagon Wheel. Both of them have a tremendous number of and a tremendous variety of shrubs coming in this season. And they're going to have things that are hardy for us, whereas if you go up the road to the big box stores, a lot of times the buyers are from Seattle, and they really don't know what we can grow. But your local nurseries really do a good job, both Wagon Wheel and Alaska Hardy. They've got some great shrub options.
All right. Well, we do have another caller. We have Findlay on line two.
Hello. I'd like to ask about starting plants from cuttings. I understand that things like black currants and gooseberries, you can just take a piece of the branch, not even the biggest part, but out near the end and put it in the ground. What do you do to make that work? You put it in water or plant food? And also, how about willow? I saw a fence in Anchorage where they planted cuttings of willow and then wove them together, and it was a growing fence that was beautiful. And where would we find the right willow? It's good for moose, too. What kind of willow would be the best, and where could we find it for cuttings? Thank you.
Well, we're actually experimenting with willow. It's called fedges, where you weave the cuttings in and make a sort of a hedge fence cross. They're very trendy right now. Unfortunately, they are moose bait. However, when you can fence them, you can pull it off. The native willows that can be used for cuttings, you can cut generally right now and cut maybe 3 to a 5 foot pole, top it to take off the flower buds. So make a straight cut at the top so that you cut off the flowering part, which has more swollen buds, and then make an angled cut down at the bottom. Keep the bottom end in water, and then you can insert them into the ground. And if you give them good water during the summer and protect them from weeds, they will usually strike root, and you can make an elaborate bunch of structures. And eventually they'll get big enough. Probably the best place to get willows for cutting that has, in my opinion, the best selection would be Vermont willows. They will sell you either 6-inch cuts, which are easy to root, and then you can grow your own rods, or you can order rods from them at considerably more money. The best one by far is Osier willow strain they sell called Bohaze Strain A, which we've experimented with, and with protection from a 6-inch cutting 2 years ago, I've got a 10-foot tree now. So if you give it a lot of water, it will grow like crazy and doesn't seem to mind the cool climate at all.
I would add, in talking about layering, I think Finley's idea is really great. We were out in the field yesterday, in fact, working on our black currants, and we had a number of black currants, and most of the fruit-bearing part of the black currant is this new growth in the last 2 years, and below that would be the older growth and not so productive anymore. So you can take and make cuttings of those upper parts, and basically a lot of those plants, if they're really well acclimated to this environment, you can just basically make a nice clean cut and put it right into the soil. Sometimes there's a lot of talk about, oh, you need to have a lot more sand in it, or you need to have this and that. I find that many of them will just be happy to root right into the ground. I'm not sure what you're thinking on that one, Tony, but the layering concept, you can just root the piece like that, or you can layer it, which means you're basically bending that branch down to the ground and pinning it down such that roots will form little rootlets right there, and then you know you have a plant that'll grow. So we sometimes put trays of soil right next to the plant, and we'll grow them into that.
Isn't that how raspberry spread?
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, got one more event on the Homer Garden Club calendar this summer. Saturday and Sunday, July 28th and 29th, the Gardener's Weekend. Brenda, could you talk a little bit about that, and maybe talk a little bit in general about the Homer Garden Club and how people can join?
Okay, well, the event you mentioned is a weekend long event. Our guest speaker this year is Brent Heath. He's the third generation owner of Brent and Becky's Bulbs. Becky is his wife, and their children are the next generation, are also working in the business. He knows bulbs up one side and down the other, and he's going to talk to us, give us two talks. One is called Bulbs as Companion Plants, which will teach us how to combine different kinds of bulbs, hardy bulbs we're talking about, that will perennialize, like daffodils and all of those wonderful little spring bulbs, like grape hyacinths or Chionodoxa. I'm trying to think of the glory of the snow is the common name of that. They're the checkered lilies, which is a relative, unstinky relative of our chocolate lily. So he's going to talk about that. That's Saturday night at Islands and Ocean. There'll be a second talk following that one, which is called 100 Years of Daffodils and More, and it will teach us a little bit about the history of daffodil and how they've been hybridized. Then on Sunday, our self-guided garden tours, there are going to be 5 fabulous gardens open. You buy a ticket, and with that you get a, which is a flower pin, you get a map, and then you can go on the tour as at the rate that you wish. The tours will be open, the gardens will be open from 10 till 5. And then following the garden tours, for those who have participated in the tours, there is a reception at Bear Creek Winery where we'll have hopefully some music. We're still working that out, but we'll have wine tasting and wonderful hors d'oeuvres. And that's from 5 till 6:30 on Sunday evening. And this is the 11th year of the event. We get about 400 people come to the gardens, and we actually had to cap the number at this point because we don't want the gardens to get too crowded. So when the tickets go on sale, which is usually the 1st of July, they'll be at the bookstore, so get your tickets early, both to the talk, because the seating is limited there to 120, and we limit the gardens to 400, and we limit the reception to 350. Those are still big numbers, but we have been selling out, so don't be last minute Homerites like usual. Oh, and then the Garden Club itself has been around for about 30 years. It was started by some homesteaders, a couple of whom are still active members of the club, interestingly enough. And it is it's probably one of the best deals in town. It's $10 for a year's membership. We usually have 8 meetings during the year, which there's always a speaker. And then you get a newsletter each month, plus a couple of extra months beyond the meetings. We're not as active in the summer in terms of meetings because we have all these other events, and we all have gardens to take care of. So. But it's a great friendly group. It's not a white gloves and hats kind of place. It's men and women, young and old, and we have a very diverse group. So the programs really vary from food crop oriented to ornamental gardening to soils and composting. I mean, there just is a huge range. We've had one on garlic this year and how to propagate garlic better. I did a talk on gardening for pollinators and what kinds of plants to include in your garden design to bring in pollinators. So there's a real wide range of topics that go on. It's a fun group.
All right. Well, I want to thank my guests, Brenda Adams, Donna Rae Faulkner, and Tony Burgess, for stopping by from the Homer Gardening Club, taking a little time out of their days getting ready for the summer. And it is 9:59 a.m. This is KBBI AM.